Hello and welcome to The Stack this week. We head to Paris to speak with the director of the Musée des Arts Décoratifs on their latest exhibition chronicling the history of Harper's Bazaar. Plus, Vince Medeiros, publisher of Huck and Little White Lies magazines, and a new architecture title from New Zealand. Enjoy! From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, here, a new title from New Zealand on their local architecture. Plus, we delve into the history of the iconic title, Harper's Bazaar. But first in the show, I had the pleasure to speak with Vince Medeiros, TCO co-founder and publisher of two titles I very much admire, Huck and Little White Lies. Vince tells me how it was to publish magazines during lockdown and reviews what's in the latest issue of both his titles.
So TCO is the parent company of Huck and Little White Lies. So we've always been first and foremost publishers, magazine publishers, very much rooted in print. Print is our game. That's where we come from. And we started out by looking at the landscape and figuring out that there were things that we could add to it, you know, in our view anyway. So Huck, for example, originated as something that was heavily influenced by surf and skate culture. I used to be a surf magazine editor back in the day and grew up sort of skating and surfing. And what we did with Huck was sort of take this sort of a nucleus of surf and skate as these rebellious anti systemic fringe sports and apply that lens to wider culture. So Huck was effectively a youth culture magazine rooted in this notion that, you know, we can tell stories that go against the grain, that challenge the mainstream, and that do something that hopefully offers counterpoints to what's out there. So, you know, Huck came from that place of offering something different, something that challenge dominant accounts, you know, and how that manifests itself is we try and embed ourselves with subcultures and tell those stories, whether it's protests in Chile or Extinction Rebellion stuff, or a new skate scene in Athens that worked with refugees, you know, covering the BLM protests. So that's our bread and butter for Huck, you know, covering counter narratives across youth culture. And Huck came about as something that hopefully added to the landscape from that point of view. And Little White Lies has that same spirit. You know, it came about as a response to you know, film journalism. We felt that there was something that we could add to the landscape, something that was perhaps more focused on aesthetics, something that added, combined honest reviews with a focus on the craft of film through a beautiful and tactile magazine. I think one of the things that really encapsulate both titles is the fact that there is a huge emphasis on aesthetics, on how things look, on how things feel, on the photography, on the illustration, on the design. That's definitely a dominant theme throughout them. So you can't tell the story of TCO without saying, first and foremost, we are magazine publishers. We love print. We're journalists and designers.
And also, Vince, I mean, they're both very much beloved titles, and I think they work very well with print. Like, I couldn't imagine them just on the online platform. But tell us, I mean, of course, COVID-19 disrupted many, many industries, but I think it's very clever what you guys did with even the latest issue of Little White Lies, because we know that every issue is dedicated, in a way, to one film. But because there was a lack of, you know, many films being released. So I think you did something very special. Let's talk about what you've done with Little White Lies, and then we go to Huck as well, which is another fascinating site that you told me. But let's start with Little White Lies. So you guys have decided during the pandemic that you have to change things a little bit, right?
As some of you may know, Little White Lies is always premised on us, you know, covering a particular film, placing that film on the cover, celebrating it, and applying that film and its various themes and issues as a lens through which we look at wider culture and the various themes that emanate from the film. Obviously, entering the world of COVID and the fact that there were very few, if any, new releases coming out, we had to try and find different ways of of you know, putting out a magazine and putting out a magazine that still resonated and made sense in this world we're living in. So what we did was we did an issue celebrating food and film, you know, sort of a themed issue, exploring, you know, making a connection between the creativity of film and the creativity that people were forced into during lockdown, you know, especially in relation to cooking, you know. So the stories look at food as a literal part of narrative and documentary film, you know, how it feeds into stories, how it's prepared for the camera, etc. But also about how people eat, habits, celebrities, food culture in Hollywood and beyond.
And what about Huck? I mean, that was a very interesting story. You guys had more or less an issue, you know, almost out, but then the pandemic started. So what did you decide to do with it?
So we had an issue ready to go in like February, but then the world shut down, right? And we had to sort of figure out what to do with it. And in the end, we decided, you know what? There's no point in putting a magazine out right now. Let's wait until we're able to actually, you know, distribute a magazine, because distribution chains were, as you know, massively disrupted. And just getting a magazine out was, you know, very difficult at the time. So what we did was we started, you know, we had a mag ready to go in February, and then lockdown happened due to COVID, and we put that magazine on hold, right? Let's wait and see what happens. And we picked it back up only in June. And when we look at the material, it's like, okay, is this magazine still relevant? You know, so much has happened, right? So much has changed. I mean, we're only, what, 6-7 months into the year, and it feels like, you know, a year has gone by, right? If not longer. So when it came to, we decided, no, this magazine remains relevant. Everything that's here speaks to the here and now and to the future as we rebuild and figure out what kind of world and what kind of society we want to live in. So when it came to, we decided, let's keep it. The material is strong. But when it came to updating the material, what we decided to do was we decided to hand it back to the people featured in it, you know, both the people featured in it, as well as the journalists and the photographers, and give them a chance to annotate, to add to it, and effectively become like almost like co-authors of their own stories. So the result is a pretty fluid sort of magazine that exists between then, i.e. pre-COVID, and now, as we, you know, we're still navigating this crisis, but we're in a different place from the place we were in, you know, earlier this year. And the whole magazine is kind of like annotated, you know, by the various people that we feature, as well as the writers and photographers.
Vince, a question about both titles, because, you know, for example, even Little White Lies, I feel that every issue is something that you would like to keep it at home. At least I do quite a few copies. Of course you have newsstand sales, but I think subscriptions must be very important for you guys, right?
Yeah, no, having a direct relationship with audiences is absolutely vital. Of course, newsstand matters, and we're out there, and we try and be as widely available as possible, not only in the UK, but across Europe, in the US, and elsewhere. But subs and having a direct relationship with the people who follow what we do and love what we do is absolutely vital. And it was interesting to see that subs did shoot up during the crisis, as well as direct sales. So online sales went up, which is, you know, great to see. Great to see that the audience, even if they're unable to get hold of a copy through their local news agents, they'll seek it out and try and find a way of getting hold of it. So that was great to see. And it's an important part of our relationship with audiences, but also crucially a big part of the business model, right? Having the ability to, you know, have subscribers, have copy sales, you know, advertising, and the various other, you know, revenue streams that make up a modern, you know, publishing company in 2020.
And Vince, I'm curious. You mentioned in the beginning of the interview that, you know, you quite like the topic of surfing, and you were the editor of Surfing, because, you know, I love the idea of surf. Just out of curiosity, was this a title from Brazil or from the UK? I'm quite curious about that.
So I used to be an editor at Surfing magazine in California. And, you know, I grew up surfing and skating, and those things were a big part of my life. And I've, you know, I'd always sort of experienced it and seen it as kind of like, you know, not only something that's great to do and awesome and fun, but something that carries a degree of sort of you know, rebellion within it, right? I mean, even if you look at the history of surfing, surfing was banned by missionaries in Hawaii when they first arrived in the 1800s. It was seen as a rebellious thing, and you know, even these days when the surf's going off and when there's waves, you know, if you're a hardcore surfer, you won't go to work. You're gonna head to the beach and get those waves. So there is kind of like this, you know, rebellious sort of myth attached to it. You know, Huck kind of very much emanates from this space, you know, it's kind of like inspired by it, but of course in its manifestation, it's just using that as a springboard, as a starting point to look at wider culture from a counter-narrative, you know, point of view, just looking at things from a nonconformist kind of perspective, if you will. So that's where surfing fits in. I mean, it's kind of like something that I brought with me from being, you know, from growing up surfing. Not very well, by the way, but I grew up surfing and I love it. And having edited surf mags, etc. And I brought that with me when I moved to London. That's like maybe 15, 16 years ago now. It's been a long time. And it's kind of like part of the, it's built into the DNA of the publication. But obviously we're not a surf mag. We're like a culture magazine that carries a little bit of that ethos in it, but our interest is in culture and broader, you know, broader things that transcends, you know, that space of action sports, surf, skate, etc.
That was Vince Medeiros, publisher of Little White Lies and Huck. Little White Lies, issue 85, is out now, and so is Huck, issue 73. And now we head to Paris, a piece by Julia Webster Ayuso, where she speaks with Olivier Gabet, director of the Museum of Decorative Arts, or Musée des Arts Décoratifs. They talk about Harper's Bazaar, First in Fashion, an exhibition that chronicles the magazine's 152-year history through fashion pieces drawn from the museum's collection.
So for the reopening of the galleries, we really wanted to do something very special. And when you think of about special in fashion, we didn't want to do a big exhibition on a big house, a big brand, or a big fashion designer. We didn't want to orientate our strategy and policy just paying homage to someone with shoes. It could have been someone else. So we prefer to find a more global subject. And one of the most exciting subject we found was in a discussion with Glenda Bailey, who just retired as the chief editor of Harper's Bazaar US, I think about 2 years ago, in a lunch in New York. We discussed that would be very interesting one day to do an exhibition on the history of Harper's Bazaar, because it's the oldest fashion magazine in the world. It was founded in 1867. Not only about fashion, but also the role of women in society, in terms of education, culture, art, also fashion. And we talked, a lot with Glenda about what could be an exhibition on the fashion magazine. The magazine is the thing that, you know, you read, you buy, you read, some very often you throw away. For the real fashion addict, you keep them to have your personal archives. And very often when you talk about fashion magazine, sadly or not, many of the projects I have by the past visited on any fashion magazine was more or less about picture, beautiful photograph published in a magazine, exhibited as the history of the magazine. And here we wanted really to do something totally different. Was not this kind of exhibition just with beautiful photograph, but more about entering into a newspaper, a magazine, in three dimension, and to see this very deep, very strong relationship between, of course, fashion photograph, but also what makes a magazine. I mean, intelligence, smart, spirit, soul, I mean, curiosity, typography, and also, because it's fashion, the dresses and the fashion itself. Because it would have been a pity to not show that fashion magazine very often participated into defining our sense of the history of fashion. In a museum, when you are buying a beautiful piece of fashion, very often the curator in the acquisition committee say, oh, this dress was published in Harper's Bazaar in 1925. And in a way, it's like a celebration of the excellency of this dress regarding the whole history of fashion. So it's not that superficial. I mean, there is very strong relation between museum world, fashion industry, and fashion magazine. And I guess that the reality of the history of fashion is in between the three important characters of the history of fashion.
Could we go and take a look at a few of the pieces?
Of course. The fact that, especially in the more contemporary time of the Harper's Bazaar, Liz Tilbury's or Glenda Bailey pays so much attention to the fashion magazine as an expression of contemporary fashion and contemporary expression of fashion. And it's interesting to see that this very strong artistic content of Harper's Bazaar in the late 19th century and early 20th century, with great artists, I mean, drawing and painting and cover of the magazine, was extended to the present world through, I mean, commission to great photographers like, I mean, Peter Lindbergh or Jean-Paul Goude to do in a great machina, you know, not just like a nice proper fashion photography, but really like a sense of grandeur, a sense of what is fashion regarding, you know, exceptional. And I think that's interesting because in the world of today, it can be quite feel out of fashion or a bit outdated. But what is interesting is that fashion is about this. Of course, today in the world of today, you have so many criteria to respect, to be proper, that at one point, you are very under the radar. I mean, okay, it's another dress or another bag. In the 90s, early 21st century, this sense of grandeur, of smashing, glamorous with the great era of top model and so on, that fashion was not like something for everyone. Fashion was really like exceptional and fabulous. And I think that in the magazine, you have this great expression of this. Here you have, for example, a series of sketches and very famous picture by Jean-Paul Goude to celebrate Karl Lagerfeld for Chanel with this incredible wedding dress. And everything is theatrical. You know, it's not like women in the street. I mean, it can impact women in the street for sure, but it's also about when you're a fashion magazine, you want to impress and you want to give a certain input to the fashion industry. It's not to be like common or like everyday. It has to be spectacular. Of course, at the end of the day, the fashion industry is a very more, useful, practical object or piece of fashion. But when you want to impress your readers and when you want to make them feeling that it's edited, it means that you have a kind of connoisseurship, you have a kind of high looking at a specific field of fashion, you have to do something quite out of scale. If not, you are not a fashion magazine. So it's very important because it was really a specificity of Harper's Bazaar from Liz Tilbury's to Glenda Bailey. With this kind of very great theatrical installation. It's Alexei Lubomirsky for Gucci, which is the urban gardens, with, very sensitive, but also very, on a grand scale, but also sometimes calling, artists by themselves to contribute to the magazine, which was really also very interesting. Remember that in the 1930s, someone like Man Ray was a great photographer for Harper's Bazaar. Man Ray was not that proud at the end of his life to have done this, but for a long time, he earned his life through this, and he did wonderful, wonderful things because it was very respectful of fashion and respectful of the models. So here, for example, you have Cindy Sherman, and she did several series for Harper's Bazaar, especially this one in March 2016. And she also transformed herself as a model for some dress. Here you have a picture with a Prada dress. And I don't know if you see the wonderful Cindy Sherman retrospective by Nick Cunningham and Paul Morehouse at the National Portrait Gallery in London last year. But when you enter into the exhibition, three of the first big photographs by Cindy was a contribution to Harper's Bazaar. She really embodied the spirit of the magazine in the fact that, okay, you can do something very daring, very dashing, when you integrate your artistic point of view into a magazine. And I think it's really part of the signature of Bazaar. And it's true that for the more recent years, so many important cover with, great actresses and singers, and to show that, I mean, also fashion is part of a popular culture, which is, I mean, a mix. And if it's part of the popular culture, it has not to be like a kind of common gray things. I mean, he has to be, I mean, it's not because you talk with more people that you have to lessen the level. Mm-hmm. You have to keep the same level because people are very demanding. I mean, they want to be respected when you propose them something which is at the right level. And that's also all the way the fashion industry works today. But for us, it was important to show that this magazine is still, I mean, very important also in terms of relationship between the fashion industry and the clients and the audience, and the fact that, you know, many fashion designers, many actresses, I mean, so many people went through the pages of Harper's Bazaar for the last two decades is quite really impressive.
That was Olivier Gabé, director of the Museum of Decorative Arts in Paris. And the exhibition is open until January next year, and it marks the reopening of the museum's recently renovated fashion galleries. And finally in the show, we have yet another new title in the newsstand, a beautiful new architecture publication from New Zealand. The name is Here, and it's edited by Simon Farrell Green. The title will look at local architecture in the country, and Simon also reveals to me the New Zealand taste when it comes to their houses, and how the country is still very much in love with print.
So I was the editor until April of an architecture and design magazine here in New Zealand. And as lockdown hit, a number of magazines closed in New Zealand, including one very large publishing company that I worked for. So something like sort of 25 magazines closed in the space of a week, most of them owned by two companies. And that seemed like an overreaction to me. I could understand that. Maybe the business didn't look good for a multinational corporate publisher, but the business of the magazine seemed quite solid to me anyway, and it seemed to me that the readers were desperate to read something. So we just decided to go out and make a new magazine and see how it went, and it's gone really, really well.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, how has it been, the reception so far? Of course, you started at the beginning with funding, and the response was amazing as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, New Zealanders are big magazine readers. So per capita, New Zealand has, or traditionally until April, had more magazines per capita than most countries in the world. And we still love the printed sort of magazine, which I think sort of speaks to our need of, or our need to sort of retreat and relax. We're sort of, you know, all the cliches about New Zealanders are true. So that was one thing. And then we sort of found ourselves in a slightly sticky position just before we launched of not having quite enough money to feel really confident about it, and particularly about launching, you know, a digital presence and things. So we launched a crowdfunding campaign here, and the results were phenomenal. We raised nearly 30,000 New Zealand dollars, which was more than enough to make us feel really sort of quite happy about going to print. So, and then from there, it's just carried on. The sales are really good. The subscriptions are picking up really nicely. The support is very much there.
And I think it's very clever that the magazine is, I mean, at least in the launch issue, very much dedicated to local New Zealand architecture. I think it's clever because, you know, of course, I'm sure it has a great audience there in New Zealand, but people are interested in things made in New Zealand. I think it's a country that, especially this year, proved to the world that, like, oh my God, good things are happening to this country. They're dealing well with the crisis. They have an interesting and a good prime minister, and other among other things.
Yeah, I mean, we're not seeing huge international subscriptions picking up yet. We've had a few. We do offer them. There's no wide scale distribution of the magazine internationally yet. That is something we're going to look at probably next year, once sort of the world settles down a little bit and maybe people have got a bit more time to listen to us. But yeah, I mean, New Zealanders are interested in New Zealand as well. I think that's the other thing is, you can get any level of content from anywhere in the world now. And so really the thing that we were determined to tell was New Zealand stories, because we felt that if we didn't take that opportunity than no one would. So you're right, telling local stories about local architects and local houses is absolutely at the core of the DNA. We would never sort of back off that.
And there's some lovely houses in the magazine as well. One of my favorites was the story of I think Jack McKinney's house in Auckland. I mean, that looks fantastic as well. I mean, can you tell us about some of the highlights of the issue, perhaps even that Jack McKinney house there?
Oh, of course. Look, I mean, we called the issue Come Home, and that was very much a post-COVID idea. Magazines weren't allowed to publish or distribute here in New Zealand under lockdown. So we had to wait until a few weeks after that was lifted to sort of get on sale. And there was a sense of, I think, celebration, but also trepidation in the country. So we wanted to create a warm, enclosing magazine that really spoke to the idea of home, because people have still sort of, you know, they are still very much sticking around home and feeling very much like they need to feel safe. And so we had a total mix of houses. And I think that's one thing that we try to do, is rather than theming the issue quite strongly around, you know, ideas of city houses or small houses or, you know, houses at the beach, which I think is what traditional architecture magazines have done, we felt that there needed to be much more of an emotional reaction to the magazine. So we have a beautiful house by an architect called Jack McKinney, as you've referred to, which is concrete, raw, off-form concrete and lots of steel and glass, and it's very glamorous and it has some beautiful furniture in it. But then we also have a house in Christchurch down in the south of the country where it was designed by two young architects themselves, one to live in, one to rent. It's a little townhouse complex, and they built it for very little, and it has plywood and polycarbonate and corrugate, and it's very, very simple but very colourful and very joyous and expressive. And both of those sort of two projects at either end felt like lovely ideas of what home could be in a new era.
And Simon, I'm sorry if it's too broad of a question, but you know, when it comes to New Zealand architecture, is there something that defines it, or you generally would say that it's a mixture of different styles?
It is definitely a mixture of styles, and I think it has always been a little bit like that. There's always probably been two sort of parallel ideas to New Zealand architecture. One has been sort of searching for some idea of a local vernacular, and I think if anyone's sort of familiar with architects like the Herbst architects, who I know Monocle have always been, you know, huge fans of, lots of timber, lots of, you know, exposed joints and breezy indoor-outdoor spaces and outdoor rooms and bits and pieces. That's sort of what you might think of as local. But then there's always been this sort of yearn to be international as well. So traditionally, you know, for the last century, we've always had these very sort of, you know, glamorous international looking houses. And there's always an interplay back and forth between those two. I think probably what there is, though, is a commitment to materials. So good New Zealand houses don't tend to look very shiny. Even, you know, luxurious New Zealand houses are quite recessive and quite matte. And you'll see concrete and stone and timber and metal rather than, you know, glossy tiles or that sort of thing. So I think there's always sort of a modesty and an understatedness to the architecture here, but there's certainly not, you know, one idea that drives every house in New Zealand.
And Simon, finally, for our listeners, you know, from around the world or even in New Zealand, if they're interested in Here magazine, where can they buy? I mean, do you have a few stockists, or is it better to go to your website perhaps?
Yeah, at this point, if you're not in New Zealand, the best place is on our website, which is thisishere.nz, and we have single copy sales. So we will sell you a magazine and dispatch it anywhere in the world. And we also sell subscriptions internationally and domestically as well.
That was Simon Farrell Green, and the first issue of Here is out now. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to the show again at monocle.com and subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or even in the Monocle 24 app. But before we go, a song for you. It's Erasure with Blue Savannah. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.